Good evening, everyone. We are in our study of Jewish history, and this week, it was planned this way, in advance of the celebration of Yom HaAtzmaut next week, we're going to go back in time and study the history of how the Zionist movement began, and with a particular focus on the challenges that were created by having this new idea, a desire for the dream to return to the ancestral homeland of the Jewish people. Something that's been a theme of our past few classes is the emancipation, the Enlightenment movement of the late 18th and 19th centuries. Last week we spoke about the different movements that were branched off of the original traditional Judaism. So we spoke about the Orthodox movement, the Reform movement, the Conservative movement, to the right of the Orthodox movement, and how all these movements began as reactions to some of the changes that the Jewish community was trying to implement in reaction to the changes that were going on around the world, and in particular in Europe.
But only for the Ashkenazi side.
Correct. So one of the major movements that the isms of the 19th century was the nationalistic movement, known, titled as nationalism. Most historians believe that nationalism, the idea of nationalism, began with the French Revolution in 1789. But in many ways, it was an outgrowth of this new found passion for being part of a group, for being part of a nation, with a language, with a culture. And the idea of nationalism had a very significant impact on Jewish communities all over the place. In a sense, the question became, to whom are we loyal? Okay, we think last week we mentioned how one of the reforms of the Reform Temple was to print a new Siddur, and in their Siddur they took out all mentions to Tzion, to Israel, to Yerushalayim, to the concept of a Mashiach. They took away any reference to a world which was outside of Hamburg, which was outside of whatever town it was that these communities were being set up. So the question of to whom are we loyal is really the question of nationalism. A person wants to be a citizen of a country. You're going to speak the language of the country, so we're going to institute that those are the languages we're going to speak in our synagogues, in our in our conversations, even in the way that the prayers are written. They're going to be translated into the language of the country. And all of this is part of the movement toward feeling that we want to have a state, the idea of statehood, the idea of peoplehood that is related to a specific place and a specific culture and a specific language. So many have understood that Zionism was born out of this movement, the idea of nationalism, the idea of peoples wanting their own state, their own place where they could gather, where they could say, we are the French people. We are Germans. We are German citizens. Zionism, in some ways, is an outgrowth of this. In the sense of a political movement, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but we all know that Zionism was not just a political movement. Because we know that Jews have been yearning to return to Israel, to their ancestral homeland, since the day that they left. Since the day that the Second Temple was destroyed in 70, in the year 70, which is basically 2,000 years ago, just under 2,000 years ago, this has been a dream that we, as a collective, wherever we were, we never stopped hoping. We never stopped thinking and praying and keeping this as part of our conscience. And it was at the forefront of our prayers and our study and our Jewish communal life. So, yes, it's true that Zionism was probably motivated in a large part by what was going on in Europe at the time. But in truth, we know, and we're going to start with Herzl, Herzl's names sound the same. Herzl's letter, essay that he wrote, which was based on a book that he had written called Judenstaat, translated as The Jewish State. And he wrote that book in 1896, and after he had met with some very important people, Max Nordau, we're going to talk about him a little bit later, one of the founding fathers of Zionism as well, he helped introduce Herzl to a number of very important people, got through to the Jewish Chronicle, which was a very popular newspaper, weekly newspaper in London, read by lots and lots of people. And this individual's high-powered individual in England asked Herzl to write a summary of his ideas, of his philosophy in this newspaper. So what you see in source number one is kind of a summary of Herzl's entire vision for Zionism that he put into this article. So I just took a few excerpts from the article, and we're going to begin with this. And it's fascinating to think that Herzl was a secular person. He didn't really grow up with a connection to tradition. A lot of the secular Zionists who we're going to meet tonight in our journey through this were rooted in traditional upbringings and later got involved in the Enlightenment and secular studies and things of that nature, and they ended up leading lives that weren't necessarily as to their traditional upbringing. But when you hear his ideas, if you were to close your eyes and not necessarily think of a person who was an irreligious person, and according to some, an anti-religious person, you wouldn't necessarily think it's coming from that type of personality. So let's read together source number one. He starts off, "I am introducing no new idea. On the contrary, it is a very old one. It is a universal idea, and therein lies its power, old as the people, which never even in the time of bitterest calamity ceased to cherish it." And as I said before, Zionism was a political movement, but even Herzl himself admits to the fact that this is something that we have dreamt about. This is the restoration of the Jewish state. It is remarkable that we Jews should have dreamt this kingly dream all through the long night of our history. Now day is dawning. We need only rub the sleep out of our eyes, stretch our limbs, and convert the dream into a reality. It's beautiful language. He wrote it in German, but the translation is done very nicely. And the Jewish question still exists. Second paragraph. Jewish question still exists. It would be foolish to deny it. It exists wherever Jews live in perceptible numbers. Just looking for a page here. Okay, I don't know where it is. I found it. It exists wherever Jews live in perceptible numbers. We have honestly striven everywhere to merge ourselves in the social life of surrounding communities and to preserve only the faith of our fathers. It has not been permitted to us. And he goes on in the rest of this piece to talk about how we thought that we could solve our problems by trying to be loyal, by trying to be patriotic, by trying to be good citizens, by trying to sacrifice, by joining the army, by speaking the language, by engaging in society, by taking on the same roles as our fellow neighbors. But we can, and he goes on, and he talks about this theme. Then he says, we are one people. Very kind of religious messages coming from a non-religious person. Our enemies have made us one in our despite, as repeatedly happens in history. Distress binds us together, and thus united we suddenly discover our strength. But we can do nothing without the enthusiasm of our nation. The idea must make its way to the most distant, miserable holes where our people dwell. They will awaken from gloomy brooding, for into their lives will come a new significance. Let each of them but think of himself, and what vast proportions the movement must assume, and what glory awaits those who fight unselfishly for the cause. A wondrous generation of Jews will spring into existence. The Maccabeans will rise again. It's an incredible piece. Powerful. Really unbelievable. You read this, 1896, he wrote this. Over 120 years ago, this piece was written. Long before, 50 years before there was a state of Israel, he was writing this idea. And this document basically inspired the first Zionist Congress, which took place in 1897. As many of us may be familiar with, what moved Herzl to start thinking about these things was an event in France called the Dreyfus Affair. That was in 1894. And it shocked these emancipated Jews. Everybody thought we were comfortable, we're good, we're very nicely settled here in our countries, in our cities. And this depth of anti-Semitism, who we said Herzl wasn't, he was assimilated into society. So for him to be moved by this moment, born in Budapest, lived in Vienna. And he published this book. First, he published The Jewish State in 1896, and then later, Alt Neuland, The Old New Land, in 1902. And he described the affair as a personal turning point. So he argued that the creation of a Jewish state, and that's his solution to the Jewish question. And we may know, we may be familiar with the fact that he was not the only one from the secular component, for sure, not the only one, but even from the religious. There were those even before Herzl who had started to talk about this idea of Shivat Zion. Chibat Zion was the name of one of the movements, which is a religious Zionist movement in the mid-1800s. Just a few names you may throw out. One of them is here in source number two, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, Rav Yehuda Al-Kalai, Rav Eliyahu Gutmacher, Rav Shmuel Mohalever. These are all Eastern European or Western European rabbis who were entrenched in Torah, entrenched in Torah practice and Torah observance, and they were promoting the idea of a return to Tzion. The Chovevei Tzion movement was in 1870. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, he quotes here in source number two, he says, it's not enough to just turn your body toward Jerusalem when you pray. And he's writing, in 1862. Okay, this is all 30 years before Herzl was publishing. And he says, Lo yaspik haroshem varemez, I'm here in source 2, Lazeu tzach kol adam Yisrael lasot haskama kvua belibo lalot ladur be'eretz Yisrael. People have to start doing this already. And we know that in 1882, the first Aliyah begins. So the first Aliyah begins. Who are the people that go in 1882? Mostly religious Jews. Are leaving Russia, are leaving other countries, and part of the impetus for this was a land purchase by a very important personality at the time, Baron Edmund de Rothschild. Baron Edmund de Rothschild begins buying land in Palestine in 1882, and that's what brought on the ability for people to move there. The first Zionist Congress was in 1897. Just before the first Zionist Congress took place, there was a protest group of protest letters that were written. In source number three, I brought two of them. Both of them came from the German community. Oddly enough, or ironically enough, kind of in contrast to last week, the first letter, A, I've labeled them A and B. A was written by the Reform community, and B was written by the Orthodox community. And they were both against Zionism. They were both against this ideology. They were both against this movement, each for their own reasons, each for their own ideas or underpinnings of why they were against it. So in the first one, you have this kind of theme where they're talking about this disloyalty, that if you are a citizen, you shouldn't be complaining about, you know, what's going on with the Jews if the government is giving you the rights. And they speak very strongly. If you look there in the second line in source 3, what more can one say if people are so naive as to believe that the West European Jews will hand over their money and they're just going to give up the land to create a Jewish organization that will reverse the entire development of the Jewish nation. 1800 years ago, history made its decision regarding Jewish nationhood through the dissolution of the Jewish state and the destruction of the temple. It's a letter by a council of Reform rabbis in Germany. The second one, and I only brought, again, here excerpts from these letters, owing to the convening of a Zionist Congress and the publication of its agenda, so many erroneous impressions have gone forth. Number one, the efforts of the so-called Zionists to create a Jewish national state in Palestine are antagonistic to the messianic promises of Judaism. So what is this a reference to? This is a reference to what some may be familiar with, the three oaths, the Gimel Shvuot, the three oaths is based on a verse that's repeated three times in the book of Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. And the Gemara in Masechet Ketubot asserts that Hashem, God, administered three oaths to the Jewish people when they went into exile. The first one says that Israel will not go up to Eretz Yisrael as a wall, kechoma, which Rashi explains, together or forcibly. While the second one warns the Jews are not allowed to rebel against the nations of the world. So many explanations have been given as to why the establishment of the State of Israel didn't violate these oaths. And there's a lot of discussion. Maybe we'll talk about it in 2 weeks when we speak about when the state was actually established. But this was one of the main attacks from the Orthodox community by creating a Zionist movement, despite the fact that it's totally secular, and that was one of the reasons why the religious were against it. It's being created by people that have no basis in Torah, no basis in observance. They were much more concerned about trying to force God's hand in history. Your job is not to go to Israel to start, you know, the redemption. Your job is to sit in Europe, sit in your countries, and wait for the Messiah to come. When Mashiach comes, then we'll go to Israel. And by the way, this argument continued, and you may be familiar with, we may touch on it next week, with many of the rabbinic leaders, community leaders, who told Jews, even in the 1930s, when things were starting to really turn for the worse, especially in certain countries, rabbinic and community leaders said, do not go, you should not leave. And part of it was rooted in this kind of religious argument. And then, you know, they quote this idea about being loyal to your country. So we have a movement that's on its that's starting to pick up pace. I want to give an example in the coming sources, number 2, 3, 4, and 5, of how history, something we've tried to do in all of our classes, of how events of history impacted the halachic or the observance of the Jewish community. Now, there were a number of aliyot that took place that we may be familiar with. The first one I mentioned was in 1882. The second one, I think, was in 1903. And then there was a third one just before World War I. So we're already starting, the numbers of people living in Israel are starting to grow slowly but steadily in a way that the community is starting to expand. And there was an important moment in 1917 called the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration brought in this new question of forming some kind of government. It wasn't obviously the British, when they took over from the Ottomans, weren't giving the Jews full right to govern themselves, but they were able to have local council. So the question of voting rights was something that became a big discussion. And as those who know the history of this time of the 20th century, the suffragist movement was a big part of what was happening now in the United States and Canada. It's very hard to see what it says on the map, but the map is a map which was a advertisement that was being posted in the United States. I don't know exactly where. It says New York City at the bottom, so I'm assuming that's where it was, and it reads as follows on the left side of the second page. The Canadian provinces of British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba extended full suffrage of their women to their women in 1916. Ontario gave full suffrage in March 1917. How long will the Republic of the United States lag behind the monarchy of Canada? That was the advertisement. I thought it was a nice picture to put on. So this is a promotional map. Yeah, it's a promotional map. Yeah, very good. And on the map, you have different colors. The white represents full suffrage. The dotted one is partial, etc. And the black ones represent no suffrage at all. And in fact, based on this pressure, you can look in source number 2, the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was voting rights. Voting rights for all citizens, and no one should be denied the ability to vote. Now, what's interesting about this, I found this in a book here in source number 3, that there were women at the first Zionist Congress in 1897. Some came with their husbands. And Herzl, he welcomed them gallantly to the Congress and addressed them as honored guests. He specified that they did not have the right to vote. But things changed. And now that we have the beginnings of what's going to later form a Jewish state, the question of should women be allowed to vote in these elections, Jewish national elections set for October 1919. So the Mizrahi Party in the Mandate Palestine was split on the question. And it basically, you know, went from the religious Zionist community, from the chief rabbinate, from the supporters. There was this big debate. And some of it revolves around a quote that we mentioned a lot last week, the Chatam Sofer, new things are forbidden from the Torah. We don't like innovation in Judaism. So women have never had this kind of right before. We're not going to all of a sudden just allow it. Another interesting point I had here. During the 1903 Congress, which I guess was the sixth Congress, Zionist Congress, that was where they debated the Uganda proposal, for those familiar with. Vera Katzman later became the wife of Chaim Weizmann. She ripped down a poster, the map of Uganda. She witnessed one of the female delegates tearing down a map of Uganda. So the movement, was moving in a stronger sense, 1904 to 1918, the Second Aliyah. Many young, idealistic female Zionists are coming to Palestine. They're creating a new female image, which echoed many of the male standards in terms of labor and involvement in society. So as I said, after 1917, the Balfour Declaration, it became apparent that we're going to have this, need to have conversation with the British, with Great Britain, to deal with critical questions that are going on there. So, may come as a surprise to some people, but the chief rabbi, the newly elected chief rabbi, Rabbi Avraham Yitzhak HaKohen Cook, who we're going to talk a lot more about in the coming moments, he was against this. He did not believe that women should be given the right to vote, and his partner in contradiction was the Sephardic chief rabbi, Rabbi Ben Sion Uziel, who's quoted here in Source 5. So let's just look at, this is just one kind of example of how now when the Jews are starting to be in charge of their own destiny, their own fate, their own politics, their own community, you have new issues that are impacting them that have to be dealt with from a Torah perspective. So first thing Rav Cook says in Source 4, regarding the law, I have nothing to add to the words of the rabbis who came before me. In the Torah, and the prophets, and in the writings, Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, and the Halacha, and the Agadah, we hear a single voice. The duty of fixed public service falls upon men. And he quotes a passage in Masechet Yevamot. It's a man's manner to dominate and not a woman's manner to dominate. Roles of office, of judgment, of testimony are not for her. This is the traditional approach of all the different books that we know about from our literature in Torah and Halacha. Striving to prevent the mixing of sexes and gatherings is a theme that runs throughout the entire Torah. Any innovation, uses that word, in public leadership that necessarily brings about mixing of the sexes in a multitude, he's against it. Then he talks about in the second paragraph, foundation of the British government, Balfour Declaration, it's an amazing thing, it's such an important development. The declaration rests on the correct view, shared by the best of Gentiles, the best of the British people, particularly a link to the land of Israel, something divinely sanctified. This theme is going to come up again and again. How the seculars view, how the secular, Zionists viewed this opportunity, and how the religious viewed it. They are influenced in that view by the holy light of the Bible. And he basically goes on to talk about how important this moment is. But he basically thinks it's an open and shut case. Women have never played a part in these kinds of decisions, so we're not going to be changing that status quo. If you look at Source 5, see a little bit of a different perspective, not just because he's a Sephardic rabbi. He was the Sephardic chief rabbi that was decided that there would be two for the community. He says as follows. I'm starting in the Hebrew passage at the top, and he says, "She'ela zu haita lesela hamachloket be'eretz Yisrael." This created a huge debate, an argument in the land of Israel. Umipana hizdaza eretz Yisrael kula. The land shook from this debate. Uchruzim ba'azharot, there were announcements and cautionary words, chavrot u'mamarim b'itonim, newspaper articles and advertisements, niparsimu chadashim livkarim lasord hishtadfut anashim chirot lagamre. He's saying this kind of in reaction. He's seen the protest, the rejection of such an idea, samchu divrei maldin Torah, ve'eilal shmirat geder hamusar v'atzniyut. He's not calling Rav Kook out by name, but he's clearly referring to Rav Kook, who basically said, it's not sanua, it's not modest, it's all these different issues that he raised. Ve'ela al shalom habayit ha-mishpachti, v'da kula maita nishenet al otah ha-agada, chadash asur min ha-Torah. And he's bringing that idea, anything new is prohibited from the Torah. But then he says, I don't really think it's prohibited from the Torah. And he comes out in favor of allowing the women to vote. We find no clear ground to prohibit this. It's conceivable that women should be denied this. I think it should not be inconceivable that women should be denied this personal right. For in these elections, we elevate leaders upon us and empower representatives to speak in our name, to organize the matters of our yeshuv, and to levy taxes on our property. The women, whether directly or indirectly, accept the authority of these representatives and obey their public and national directives and laws. Women are just have just as much of a say in what's going to happen in this society as the men do. How then can one simultaneously pull the rope from both ends, lay upon them the duty to obey those elected by the people, yet deny them the right to vote in the elections? It's a good argument. It's not necessarily a halachic argument, but it's an argument from logic. If anyone should tell us that women should be excluded from the voting public because their minds are flighty, datan kalot, so Gemara and Masechet Shabbat and Kiddushin, and they know not how to choose who is worthy of leading the people, we reply, well then, let us exclude from the electorate also those men who are of flighty minds, and such are never lacking. However, reality confronts us clearly with the fact that both in the past and in our times, women are equal to men in knowledge and wisdom, dealing in commerce and trade, and conducting all personal matters in the best possible way. Has it ever been known that a guardian is appointed to conduct the affairs of an adult woman against her will? Okay? So he's pretty strong in favor of this, and he brings a few other examples. A feminist, so definitely a supporter of the suffragist movement, and he feels that it's completely justified. So this is a window into one issue that the state of Israel will deal with for the rest of its history, where all of a sudden the issues that were dealt with by a non-Jewish government are now being dealt with by a Jewish government. But it's intersecting with Torah life, and these are issues that were not easy to deal with. And you can see how two of the leaders of the Jewish yeshuv, as it was called, the Jewish settlement pre-state Palestine, were at odds on how to address this issue.
We're still at odds today.
Now you touched on the business of Uganda.
Yes. Yes. I'm gonna come back to it a little bit. But in a way, that plan was only I think it was spoken about at it was suggested at I think the fifth Zionist Congress and then voted upon in the sixth. But it was pretty quickly faded to the background. Go ahead. I'm not sure. They did let women vote. I don't know if it was in that election. It might have been the next one, as far as I remember. But I haven't seen anywhere that he changed his opinion. But what's important to understand about Rav Kook, and we're going to spend a lot of time now looking at some of his writings, is that he saw himself as the bridge between the old yeshuv and the new yeshuv. And that's why I titled this class, The New and the Old Yeshuv. Because when I use those terms, what I'm referring to by the old yeshuv is the religious Jews who came to Israel, let's say in the first Aliyah, or who had been there even earlier. There were Jews who already started arriving in Ottoman Empire then, you know, in the 1500s, in the 1600s, moving to Tzfat, establishing the Kabbalistic city of Tzfat. In small numbers, but in particular, it was the religious Jews who did kind of heed the call at the beginning. Later on, the secular Jews did move in much larger numbers during the Aliyot, various Aliyot from the late 19th to the 20th centuries. And what Rav Kook, who was a thoroughly religious person, as you can see in the picture here. This is a younger version of Rav Kook in the bottom source number 6. He was born to a Torah observant family. He went to yeshivot. He was known to be an Elui, a very bright young child, studying with some great people of the generation. And he amassed within himself lots of different kinds of Torah perspectives, Hasidic thinking. But at the same time, Rav Kook was also an educated person. He was well read. He knew about secular society. And what he saw when he came to Israel, he came in 1904. He was offered the position of chief rabbi of Jaffa, and he came in 1904. And when he came, he saw people working the fields. He saw Jews trying to build up the land physically. And by and large, the people who were involved in these enterprises were secular people. Were not Torah observant in any sense of the word, but they left their homelands, they left Europe, they left their cities, they left perhaps jobs and families behind in some cases, and they came to a land that was empty, and they're starting to build. And he saw there was something here that needs to be looked at more seriously, and we can't just discount these people. He was uncompromising when it came to halachic observance, as you saw before, when it comes to the voting issue. But he was completely open to every single Jew and what he felt was the beginning of something really great happening in history. And he writes this ma'amar, this essay called Ma'amar Hador, the essay of the generation. And he talks in here about what he's seeing. And here's what he writes. It's fascinating to get a window into what he was seeing around him. Our generation is a great generation. A generation that is completely wondrous. It's comprised of total opposites. Light and dark intermingled with one another. It's lowly and degraded, yet also lofty and exalted. It is completely guilty, reference here to the religious lack of religious observance, yet completely innocent. Rav Kook felt that these individuals were just never educated. They were never shown a Torah world. They were never shown an education that would give them an exposure to what Torah is. We must understand its true nature so that we might be able to assist it. He felt we can't just push them aside and neglect them and say, they're not real Jews. This generation is strange, wild, rebellious, but also elevated and distinguished. It seems that beyond this chutzpah is in full force, the youth are unabashed in front of their elders, and they even embarrass them. And here he's referencing a discussion in the Talmud that at the time of the Mashiach, the young people are going to be chutzpahdik to the elders. They're not going to get up on the bus when the old person gets on, and they're going to disrespect them. They're not going to speak nicely to them. Those are all signs that something major is happening in history. Opposite this behavior, we find the motions of loving kindness, honesty, justice, turn the page, mercy growing strong, the forces of science and idealism bursting forth. A large contingent of this young generation do not feel any loyalty to that which is customary, but not because their souls are darkened, rather because their souls have risen beyond that place. And essentially, it's flowery language, but essentially what Rav Kook is talking about here is he saw a generation who was dissatisfied with the status quo. They said, we don't want this European Judaism anymore. In many ways, they were talking about the religious ghettoized version of what they understood to be Judaism. He said, we want to invent a new kind of Jew, and we can only do that in this place, the new Yeshuv, where they were going to work the land, to work the human body. And Rav Kook saw this as, you're working the land of Israel. Maybe you're doing it from a motivation which is secular, but he saw in it kernels of holiness, kernels of spiritual growth that he hoped would in the future blossom into something great. For example, okay, and this is a really a fascinating insight into this whole time of history. Rav Kook writes in many places, but in one example here in source number 7, about the importance of exercise. Okay, importance of being strong, of having a strong body. Not about the importance of Torah learning, the importance of strength. And he says, the exercise that the youth of Israel engage in to strengthen their bodies in order to be a strong, brave force for the nation contains within it the spiritual strength of the greatest tzaddikim, who are engaged in unifications of the divine names, a Kabbalistic reference, to increase the expression of divine light in the world. And one revelation of that light cannot stand without its corresponding partner at all. So he's seeing this rebirth of the Jewish people, not just through the lens of we need to be strong because we have to work the land, because we have to have an army, because we have to be able to protect ourselves, but he saw that as a spiritual pursuit as well. And oddly enough, or ironically enough, he was echoing very staunchly secular elements within the Zionist movement. Max Nordau, who coined the term muscular Judaism, this was his term. He spoke at the Second Zionist Congress. And I put it here in German. It's the first line in Source 7. I'm going to do a bad job reading it, but I'll try to read it anyway. Der uns wieder das verloren gegangen muskel Judentum schaffen soll.
That's pretty good.
Pretty good. We must think once again of creating a Jewry of muscles. Muskel Judentum. That was the coin that he phrased. And he writes, the fear of constant persecution, he's writing in 1898, it's his second Zionist Congress, this is a speech. Fear of constant persecution turned our powerful voices into frighted whispers, which rose in a crescendo only when our martyrs on the stakes cried out their dying prayers. Jews cannot be afraid anymore. Jews cannot hide from their enemies anymore. At last we are allowed space for our bodies to live again. Let us take up our oldest traditions. Let us once more become deep-chested, sturdy, sharp-eyed men. Okay? So, and this became an obsession. It became an obsession. Max Nordau was a Zionist leader, born in 1849 in France. And he was the co-founder of the World Zionist Organization. As I mentioned before, he's the one who actually kind of helped Herzl become famous. He got Herzl introduced to a lot of the higher up people. A very important person who championed this kind of ideology was one of the great founders of the state, Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky, who was, he was the one who started the self-defense units in Russia, right? In 1903, just after the Kishinev pogrom. So let's get to the Kishinev pogrom, which in many ways was a major turning point in this whole story. Kishinev pogrom was April 6, 1903, Tsarist Russia, 2 days of mob violence. And for those who know anything about the Kishinev pogrom, it was on Easter Sunday, and it was basically orchestrated by the church, pretty much orchestrated by the church. And on the first day, 49 Jews were dead, 500 wounded, 1,300 homes and businesses looted, etc., etc. And this caused a huge shockwave, not just because of the death toll, but because of the gruesomeness of it, the way it was described in New York Times articles, and it was covered in world media.
The floodgates opened, people left Russia.
In many ways, it was the beginning of the end of European Jewry at that time, especially in Russia. So Chaim Nachman Bialik, who also grew up traditional, he was living in the time in Odessa, which was the great center of Russian Jewish culture. He was a young poet. He had already written one poem, which we're going to look at in a few weeks. And he writes this poem called In the City of Slaughter, where he basically, after he had interviewed people who had survived the Kishinev pogrom. And the poem does two things. It describes the gruesomeness in graphic detail, and you can find the whole poem online. And it does one more thing, which was much more important, and it was that he was reflecting on Jewish passivity, that Jews can no longer be passive. And this is just one example of this. Okay, crushed in their shame, they saw it all, they did not stir nor move. He's talking about the bystanders, the Jewish bystanders, who didn't have the strength or the passion or the motivation to fight back. They did not pluck their eyes out, they beat not their brains against their wall. Perhaps, each watcher had it in his heart to pray, "A miracle, O Lord, and spare my skin this day." Those who survived this foulness, who from their blood awoke, beheld their life polluted, the light of their world gone out. How did their menfolk bear it? How did they bear this yoke? They crawled forth from their holes. And look what he writes. This is also a break from... He was angry that he felt that traditional Judaism forced Jews into being passive, that it turned Jews into being scared to fight back. So he writes, "They fled to the house of the Lord, to the synagogue. They offered thanks to him that we survived, the sweet benedictory word. The Kohanim sallied forth," and there were many, here he's referencing, there were many women who had been raped during this pogrom. "So they went to the rabbi's house and they said, 'Tell me, O rabbi, tell me, is my wife, my own wife, permitted?' The matter ends and nothing more, and all is as it was before." Intense words. And the rest of the poem is just as intense, some ways more intense. He talks about people hiding behind casks and not being able to come out and fight or do anything. And he felt very strongly that something had to be done. So it was at this time that Zev Jabotinsky started his self-defense units, and then he made Aliyah, and he started self-defense units in Israel. And slowly those self-defense units eventually became some of the well-known pre-state militias, which ended up, in the end, becoming Tzahal, which we know today is Israel Defense Forces. So Herzl dies in 1904, July 3rd, 1904, the 20th day of Tammuz. He was 44 years old. It's understood that he basically died out. He had a heart problem from when he was very young, but most people understand that it was his activity in the Zionist movement that basically led him to his death. He wasn't slowing down; he was speeding up. He was trying to take on too much, and he dies in 1904. So he didn't live to see the Seventh Congress, where they voted down. I think that was one that they voted down the Uganda plan. But Rav Kook was living in pre-state Palestine at that time, and he was asked to deliver a eulogy. And the problem with Rav Kook giving a eulogy to Herzl is he's basically giving a eulogy to a non-religious person, and it could be viewed in a very negative way. So what he did, in a sense, is he basically agreed to give the eulogy, but he didn't talk about Herzl at all in the eulogy. He spoke very generally. And in his eulogy, here's just a very short passage from it in Source 9. He says as follows, "Kishem sheyatzar Hashem yitbarach ba'adam hagufa neshama. God created within man a body and a soul. Kein heichin b'Yisrael b'yichud shnei eila hakochot. So he prepared within the Jewish people these two powers," meaning within the nation, "a spiritual body and a physical body. Hakoach hamagbil le'erach haguf ha'enoshi. The Jewish people represent a physical entity. V'hatzad ha'sheni etzem hakoach l'shichlu l'rechniyut b'atzma. And then on the other hand, this idea of the spiritual side as well. Alkein ra'ui lanu lasim el ha'lev l'ishtadel l'mtiyat yirachdut. Our role," and he's talking contemporarily, "is to combine the two forces. The building of the physical aspects of the Jewish people, which at that time was the agricultural movement, later to become forming a government, a military, an economy, etc. These are all aspects of a physical concepts within a nation." And that's when he means when he says, "Eitz Yosef and Eitz Yehuda," the tree of Joseph and the tree of Judah. The tree of Joseph represents, as we know, Joseph was the mashbir. He kept the Jewish people and the world, in a way, sustained during the years of the famine in Egypt. Yosef represents the physical sustenance of the people. And Yehuda, who is the progenitor of the kings, he represents the spiritual side. Both of these need to be working together in order to be a successful, healthy nation. The Sameach bi naru chavetz ha'chaim abriim, healthy, physical life. Hamefa'im miklal be'uma. V'ladat shetchuna hazor eina tachlitam shi Yisrael. It's not the only thing. So here he's quietly and subtly referencing Herzl's vision and work that he did, without actually speaking about him directly. Let's turn to the next piece. We just have two more things to discuss, and then we'll wrap up. Another important personality who was part of the early Zionist movement was a young man named Shalom Yosef Agnon, otherwise known as Shai Agnon. And Shai Agnon had a very close relationship with Rav Kook. Shai Agnon, born to a traditional family, went more toward secular, but then ended up becoming religious again when he was in Israel. And he has a lot of different things that he wrote. When he met Rav Kook, he writes about it. It's in the footnote here in the bottom. He says, Rabbeinu HaGadol, Rav Mitzvah Kokoyim, how close he drew me in his humility, was kind enough to read my story, which was then still a manuscript. When he returned it to me, he said these exact words. This is a true Hebrew-Jewish story, flowing through the divine channels without any barrier. So this is another element of the early movements, literature, Hebrew language, all of these things were part of what Chaim Nachum Bialik was a big part in this as well. And in some of his stories, he talks about a man who many believe to be Rav Kook. I just want to mention that in his Nobel Prize address, I had it somewhere, in his Nobel Prize address, which was in 1966 in Stockholm, Shai Agnon was given a prize for literature. He writes about, at the beginning of his speech, he spoke in Hebrew, and then he went into English when he gave his acceptance speech. And he says, as a result of the historic catastrophe in which Titus of Rome destroyed Jerusalem and Israel was exiled from its land, I was born in one of the cities of the exile. But always I regarded myself as one who was born in Jerusalem. And he goes on. So this was Shai Agnon. And he writes the following. And what do your young men do? Said the rabbi in a conversation with somebody that he met. As for the young men of Israel, I said, may I myself serve as expiation for their sins. They do not study like the scholars or pray like the pious men, but they plow and sow and plant and give their lives for this land that the Lord swore to give to our forefathers. And what was Shai Agnon, anyone who ever read Shai Agnon, almost all of his writings are about the conflict between traditional Jewish life and the modern world. That was essentially, in a nutshell, the theme of his writings. So look what he says here. He says, because they give their lives for the land, he has entrusted the land to them. The rabbi's eyes filled with tears, but he paid no heed to his tears and said, and what about the Sabbath? A verse came to my mind, and see the good of Jerusalem all the days of thy life. I quoted, see in the imperative. It is a man's duty to see what is good in Jerusalem and not the evil, heaven forbid, on the Sabbath. See the good, and don't focus on the bad. I said to him, Jews set their work aside and dress in goodly garments. He that can study, studies. He that can read, reads. And he that can do neither strolls with his wife and children, speaking the holy tongue, and fulfilling in his own person the saying, everyone that walks 4 cubits in the land of Israel and speaks the holy tongue is assured of life in the world to come. So in many ways, it encapsulates who Rav Kook was. Rav Kook respected the fact that these people were in the country, were doing something positive for this movement. He wasn't happy that they were violating Shabbat, but the message here is not to focus on that part. In a last comment, we're going to look at quickly. This is obviously a huge topic. One major challenge that came up in the early years of the new yeshuv. And that was the question of Shemitah. Shemitah, described here in source number 11, is the biblical Sabbath. The biblical Sabbath of the land. The biblical Sabbath of the land, which takes place every 7 years. And as the Jews started to return to the land, this question became increasingly challenging and central to the vitality of the yeshuv and the continuation of the growth of the yeshuv. So what happened was, and this wasn't the first time that a permission was given, Rav Kook in 1909, on the eve of the Shemitah of 1909-1910, because the Shemitah year begins on Rosh Hashanah. Shemitah year officially begins on Rosh Hashanah, which will probably fall September-October time of any given year. And it was probably the case as well then. So Rav Kook gives a permission for the farmers in the country to sell their lands to non-Jewish, in this case probably Arab, locals, Arab farmers or Arab people that lived in the vicinity. This is known as the Heter Mechira, the permission to, of the sale of land in Israel. It's a very complex issue, but we should know, a lot of people have this misunderstanding that Rav Kook did give this permission, but he was not the first one to have done so. Four Shemitahs already, three Shemitahs prior, so we're already talking 21 years of history of Jews already being in the land, the Heter Mechira was already granted on a smaller scale. There was one difference in 1909 than all the previous times, and that was exports. The agriculture had developed to such an extent that they were already starting to export produce to countries outside of the yeshuv. So Rav Kook wrote an 120-page defense, basically a dissertation of why he thinks he's right, why he thinks they're allowed to do this, and not necessarily saying that this is forever, that this is the ideal. He doesn't even really think it's the ideal, but he believes that it is correct for this time. And here's what he writes in the introduction. This is actually in the heart of the book. The sabbatical, in source 12, the sabbatical dispensation by a permit of sale on which we rely was never used and does not appear to have been relied upon by the early sages of blessed memory, time of the Second Temple, and all the days of the sages of Jerusalem Talmud, nor when the population continued to live in the land of Israel afterward. So for most, almost the entire history of the Jewish people, there was settlement in the land and people were working the land, Jews never sold the land away. Bless you. This is not surprising. In the early generations, the need was not so pressing. Whenever there was no pressing need, the sages did not want to publicize dispensations based on legal fiction. What he means by legal fiction here is the sale, the same concept that people may be familiar with the sale of chametz, that many people do before Passover, before Pesach. It's a legal fiction. You know that you're going to get the land back when the Shemitah year is over, but you're allowed to sell it anyway, and the sale counts as a sale, as a legal binding sale. Following the maxim, it is the glory of the Lord to conceal a matter. In the early days, when Jews lived primarily by working the land for sustenance, turn the page, it was possible to observe the sanctity of the sabbatical year according to the details of the laws without any dispensation. But in our days, when the existence of the community depends on commerce, as I mentioned, there was a change at this point, commerce in the produce and crops and agricultural settlements, the effect of preventing commerce would also lead to the destruction of future stability. Under these circumstances, it is certainly our obligation to introduce the dispensation by way of sale of the land. So as I said, a 120-page essay, feel free to go out and read it in your free time. It's dense, it has a lot of Torah sources in it, and it's impressive. It's an impressive document. There are four halachic considerations that Rav Kook took into account, which is what he based his opinion on. And they are as follows. Without going into detail, I just listed them as questions. Number one, is the fulfillment of Shemitah a rabbinic or Torah observance in contemporary times? What this means is Shemitah, is the observance of Shemitah a Torah commandment at all times in history, or might it be dependent on certain criteria, such as most of the world Jewish population need be living in the land of Israel? Perhaps the law only applies when you have a majority of Jews living in Israel. Perhaps the law only applies biblically when we are observing what we call the Yovel, which is the 50th year after seven Shemitah cycles. So on and so forth. Rav Kook was of the opinion that Shemitah in contemporary times is rabbinic. Why would the rabbi say, keep the Shemitah anyway, even though you don't need to keep it from a biblical standpoint? So Rav Kook explains that the ideal is that we will one day again keep the Shemitah. And this, the Shemitah is great for all of the environmentalists. They love this stuff. This is a great, you know, it's a great pitch for them. So they were all over this stuff. Does non-Jewish acquisition of land in the land of Israel suspend its sanctity? This is also an interesting question. If you sell the land to a non-Jew, does that take away its obligation for Shemitah to be observed? Is it even possible to sell the land in the land of Israel to a non-Jew? We have prohibitions against selling land in Israel. Talk today about giving land away, land for peace. It's not just a political question, it's a halakhic question as well. And lastly, does such a fictional sale even have validity to affect suspension or sanctity of the land? What Rav Kook does, and one of his main arguments, and we'll move on after this, is he says that if we don't allow the farmers to sell their land, what's going to end up happening is they won't be able to work the land. They're going to have to keep Shemitah in its fullest sense. They're going to lose all their exports. And then they're going to lose the land because they're not going to be able to sustain it. So he saw the permission to sell as actually based on not giving away the land, but maintaining, keeping the land. Because if we don't sell, in the long run, it's going to end up losing everything that we had started. So he was very sensitive to this issue, and he wasn't just talking to people who were religious. He was thinking about the larger population, as I mentioned before, a bridge. So there were many people who were upset when Rav Kook came out with this Shabbat Haaretz perspective. The Ritbaz, Rav David Volofsky, who was one of the vociferant opposition to Rav Kook in many, many, many different areas. He lived in Tzfat, and in Source 13, there was a long correspondence. It's a 10-page letter in one of Rav Kook's books called Igrot, The Letters of Rav Kook, where Rav Kook defends his decision to give this permission, and he talks about how, you know, really these Jews are really good inside, and they're good people, and you shouldn't judge them based on the fact that they don't keep Shabbat, and on and on, and they're doing something great, and don't call me, and this is the line that I wanted to read, if you look in the middle, my dear friend, he's talking to his friend the Ritbaz, he says, if all Zionists would love the land of Israel and seek the settlement of the Holy Land for the same reason and holy goal that I have in mind, because it is God's land, special and beloved out of the entire world, containing unique holy qualities of foster prophecy and divine inspiration, then it would be certainly a great honor for every important rabbi and Torah scholar and tzaddik to be such a Zionist. Even your honor should find nothing objectionable in this form of Zionism. So, not everybody agreed with him. Not everybody was on his side. He had a lot of people who were against him. The Chazon Ish, Rav Yishayahu Karelitz, who was the leader of the B'nai Brak, the Haredi, early Haredi community, in Israel, he felt that, this whole concept of selling the land is not a real thing. And Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, Rav Chaim Yosef Sonnenfeld, who in Source 14, he criticized Rav Kook as well. Point being, we're not going to read that source inside, point being, this was obviously a battle. But it was a holy battle. And it was a battle for defining what the future of the state of Israel was going to look like. So what we saw this evening is we looked at a lot, but what we did see is we saw the early ideologies. These early ideologies, you have to remember, A.D. Gordon, I didn't even mention him, Labor Zionism, and Max Nordau, and Zev Jabotinsky. These are all people that ended up forming parties that we know today. Think about Menachem Begin, who was basically the one who continued Jabotinsky's path. All of that began here, with Herzl's first meeting, with Herzl's first vision. And I'll just conclude with, when Herzl came home, this is what they say, when Herzl came back from the first Zionist Congress, he was ecstatic. It was more than he could have ever imagined it would turn out to be. And he wrote to himself in his diary, or he said to himself, it was recorded somewhere, he said, I believe that today, with this Congress, I've founded the State of Israel. He wrote that in 1897. And 50 years later, he didn't get to live to see the day. But 50 years later, basically just over 50 years later, his dream came true. And it's something that we have to have a lot of appreciation for, something that we have to stop during our journey through the Jewish experience and the Jewish calendar to recognize and to celebrate. Because most of the people that we spoke about tonight did not have a chance to see that day come. But we owe so much to all of these various individuals, rabbis, community leaders, and visionaries who started the process and were the beneficiaries of that process that was begun. So everyone should have a Chag Sameach in honor of that.